and talk to Ben Tyler. Ben Tyler has on the console here on the counter 5 duck calls, and I think he has more in his bag. He has something in his bag, probably a lot in his bag. He's a retired shipwright. I worked with Ben at the Shipwrights Co-op. He was a member of the Shipwrights Co-op. I was a subcontractor. I wired. I believe, Ben, you did mostly interiors, right?
Interiors and some structural stuff, too.
Yeah. I remember you doing the really lovely little part stuff inside of boats.
Or you're right, the interiors of the consoles, mm-hmm. where all the instruments were, some of the radio station, the radio station part of it, the galleys.
Yeah, the galleys, yes, indeed.
Mm-hmm. And then when it came time, occasionally I'd have to go put a new stem in or a plank or something like that.
And how did you learn all that stuff?
I went to the boat school in 87 and went 6 months there. And when that part was over with, they had boats coming in that I could repair. So I stayed another 6 months, 8 months, something like that, and repaired for them. And then I came down to the yard and started working for the Shipwrights Co-op as a contractor. And then after a couple of boats, they said, would you like to join? So I joined the co-op and was there for 27 years.
And retired.
And retired from there in 2013.
And you were not a founding member, but you were pretty much right about the time of the founding, I think.
Yes, right. I think they founded in 81, and I got there in 87.
And my recollection is that when you came to the boat school, you left behind, and we're going to talk about where you left it behind in a moment, but you left behind an education and, I suppose, some work in a natural resources field.
Yeah, I got a degree from the University of Idaho in wildlife resources. And when I got out of college, when I graduated from college, a couple of friends of mine and I decided, let's go to Alaska. So we got on the ferry in Seattle, when it used to leave from Seattle, the Columbia, with our kayaks, two kayaks. We got off in Ketchikan and then waved the ferry away, and it was on the dock and trying to figure out, now what are we going to do? So the next morning, we spent the night on the dock. The next morning, we got in our kayaks and went north. And we went to all the little towns, Wrangell, Petersburg, Myerschuk, Glacier Bay, into Juneau. And it was like a 50-day excursion. And Dave, who was with me, he went off to work in the ice fields. He was a botanist. And I continued on into Glacier Bay for another few weeks, then came back and then started training to be an observer for the National Marine Fisheries. And I would go out to sea on Japanese boats in the North Pacific and Bering Sea, and I'd be on each boat for about a month at a time and collecting samples, species composition, that kind of stuff. And then I would do a coded message and send it back to the Coast Guard, and then they would relay it back to National Marine Fisheries, which is through NOAA. And I did that for several years.
And why did you give that up?
I got tired of being out at sea all the time.
And it's rough seas out there, too.
Yeah, rough seas. It didn't matter the time of year. I had to be out there. You know, I was in there January, February, sometimes in the summer. But occasionally we'd have, since these boats stayed out in the ocean, out in the Bering Sea, we'd have cargo ships coming up, tying up to them to offload what we caught, and then bring on provisions. But it's a lot of times, the weather was so rough, we would have to go into the lee of an island like St. Matthew's Island, which is way out there. We'd get in behind the lee of that island, and the sea would be just slush. Not frozen yet, but just slush. And we'd offload the fish onto that cargo ship and then take on provisions. And that's like, there was no daylight. It was like in the middle of winter. Like the sun was down. You never saw the sun. So it got a little old. And it was a very interesting thing to do. I had to learn how to speak Japanese to do my job.
Do you still speak Japanese?
Not very much.
Can you say something for me in Japanese?
Kore wa nan desu ka?
Good enough for me.
So, and then after I was going out to sea a bunch, I went back to Idaho, and I had a little Airstream trailer I lived in, and 1956 model, which I still have. And I started getting with these guys making timber frame houses. And so we built houses around in Montana and would ship them to back east. We made a few of them in Idaho.
So when you were doing this, were you discovering something about yourself that you hadn't known? Or had you always had some skill with your hands and interest in working with them?
I've always had some skill with my hands, but that kind of at that point in my life, it was my skills were just being unleashed, and I was able to like be more creative and do things I would like to do, you know. And I was realizing that, hey, I like doing this kind of stuff, and I continued on, and I got better and better and better, and. Now that I've retired from the co-op, I have more time to spend on what I had started doing when I was, like, really little, was making duck calls and carving the scenes. Like here's a couple of calls right here that have ducks flying in, ducks taking off, and then checkering, the fine checkering you see on gun stocks. You're able to put that on this on these duck calls.
You ever make a musical instrument?
I tried making a fiddle one time. And I still got the parts, but I haven't finished it yet.
You know, there is one of your former colleagues at the Shipwrights Co-op. Doesn't make duck calls, but does some wonderful carving. And, you know, when I learned that you were doing this kind of carving, I was surprised. I didn't know about it. Uh-huh. But Leif Knutson.
Oh, yeah, Leif.
He carves for paddles mostly, got involved in the native paddling that happens in the summertime.
I've seen some of his paddles. He does some really nice work.
Really, really nice work.
He's a very creative fellow.
So your duck calls, they come from your distant your family's distant past and from the place that you were raised. And where was that?
I was raised in northern Mississippi in a little town called Hickory Flat, which is in between Holly Springs and New Albany, and it's north central, and it's right near some of the best duck hunting anywhere in the South. My grandfather, he used to live in Mark Tree, Arkansas, which is a little town northeastern Arkansas. And he lived along the St. Francis River. He had a houseboat there and a hardware store. And he started duck hunting with some friends and got up with this one guy who was a really good duck hunter and duck call maker. And he was so good that my grandfather got inspired by him and started making his own calls. In those days, nobody used lathes or anything. They used a pocket knife for making these calls. And so he learned how to make these calls.
Can I assume that he was a duck hunter also?
He was a duck hunter, yeah. And like in 1939, he moved to Memphis where his father lived. And they moved there to take care of his mom and dad. And in his basement, he started making duck calls in his basement with two cronies of his, and they started a business called Ben John Duck Calls. And they made them through the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. And they're all over the place. They're collector's items right now. In Memphis, there was like this bunch of guys who lived there who were, it was like the duck call making mecca. Everybody who wanted to learn how to make duck calls would go there and learn from these guys. And there's some phenomenal duck call makers back in those days, or there is still now, too.
So what makes for a phenomenal duck call?
The woods that you use. Mostly mahoganies, walnuts, bodock, which is called hedge, or Osage orange is another name of it. It's a real hard yellow wood, and it makes a hard or a crisp sound. It's kind of like a crisp sound, like the black wood on clarinet. It's a hardwood, and it carries the sound better. But the insides of the duck calls are called stoppers or tone boards, and they're usually made out of cedar. And the reason they use cedar, eastern red cedar, is that when you're blowing a call, you're expelling a lot of moisture through the call. And if you use anything besides cedar, the wood would swell and change the shape of the tone board so you would change the sound. You didn't want that. You want it to be a sound to carry through the whole morning while you're calling. And cedar allowed you to do this.
Just thinking about duck calls all of a sudden reminds me of when I first got this iPhone. Okay, I got this iPhone. Mm-hmm. I was actually using it for a telephone, which I don't do much anymore, and I set up a ringtone. And one of my choices was duck. Okay, that was fine, right? So my son and I were walking across, Robbie and I were walking across the University of Washington campus. And at that time, not only did I sometimes use my phone as a phone, mm-hmm. I sometimes had the ringer on. And it's in my pocket. And we hear ducks. And we start looking around. Where in the world are these ducks? And there were no ducks around. We were walking across
the lawns anywhere.
Not a duck anywhere at all. It was really baffling until I remembered that, yes, my telephone was pretending to be a duck. I would assume that some calls not only are more, I mean, the ones I wish our listeners could see what I have in front of me, because we have woods, we have the horn of an elk, I think.
That's an elk antler.
The elk antler.
Yeah.
But there's also the matter of effectiveness. They have to really do the job, don't they?
Yeah, right. There's a lot of calls out on the market right now that don't really sound like a duck.
Do the ducks know the difference?
The ducks know the difference. Especially when you're out on a blind and you got some decoys right in front of you, and you hear somebody way on the other side of the valley in the flooded field calling, and the ducks flare away from them, and they come over to where I am, and they land in front of me instead of this other guy who's got this weird sounding call. Or maybe the call may be fine, maybe he just didn't know how to blow it right.
Well, explain then about that part.
Well, most people don't know it, but it's the female that does all the quacking and the calling. So what you're trying to do is imitate a female call. And you have, like, if you have a flock of ducks flying by and you have your decoys down there, you want to get their attention, you do what is called a hail call. And that's usually when they're far away. You do a hail call. And that kind of gets their attention, get them turning. Once they start turning and it's coming towards you, you want to stop your hail call and start doing a feed call. And then once they get closer, you stop calling altogether and just be quiet. You want to let them fly over you. They're looking the whole time. Fly over you. Once they get past you, do your turnaround call. Turnaround call and feed call. And you can throw in a lonesome duck call, too.
A lonesome duck call. All right.
That's if, like, there's, like, one or two ducks. So you turn them around, and then you finish them up, which is like a feed call, a little chuckle. And they're usually at that time, they've got their wings cupped, and they're coming into the decoys.
You're making music. So each one of these calls can do all of those?
Oh, yeah.
Well, I think it's time for a demonstration.
Oh, okay.
Would you please? Yes, and you're going to have to... identify each element of the call because we're trying to bring them in from afar, and then we're trying to get them to settle down so they can be your duck dinner, I guess.
Okay.
And this is mallards primarily?
This is mallards. Mm-hmm. Although I do have a call right here that'll do pintails, wigeon. We have a lot of wigeon around here, especially in Center Valley where it floods. There's wigeons, pintails.
Lake Short?
Lake Short. And then also I can do a teal call.
We'll do a
mallard call. And this is a walnut call. It's got ivory inlays on it. It's got a duck taking off of water and a duck landing. And it's checkered, too. So the first part of this call is a hail call. Attention. Now, when they started turning around and coming towards you, you start doing a feed call. And once they've got close to you, you kind of quiet down because you don't want them to pinpoint exactly where you are. You want them to fly over. Then you do a turnaround call. Now they've turned around and they got their wings cupped, and you want to just kind of hush because they're coming and they got their wings cupped and they're coming right into you. And you get ready to have some duck for dinner.
Could you do all of those just in short order without talking?
Okay.
And there they are.
Huh.
So how, I mean, that's just one piece of, well, maybe two pieces of wood. I guess it's the wood that, how does it work?
Well, this is the tone board, and there's a cellulite reed in here.
Cellulite.
It's usually.
Okay, I see that. Uh-huh.
Nowadays, they sell mylar for this, but this is cellulite, and this has got, I got sheets of this. When I last visited my mom down in Mississippi, I went into her basement, and she's got all this stuff still laying around that my grandfather gave us before, after he died. I got it from my grandmother. But I had sheets of this, so I made use of it. This is like 18,000ths thick. The mylar you can buy making duck calls is 10,000ths thick. And so I also got jigs, metal jigs that you insert the wood into, and it cuts that shape. And for the life of me, I couldn't get them to sound right with these with the mylar reeds. And when I found this reed material, I realized, oh, this is thicker material. Those jigs must have been made for this material. So I brought this home, started cutting it, and it came out perfect tones. I didn't have the right reed material. So the shape of this actually makes the sound, and it's the tone that you get. And there's like a little cut underneath that the air flows through. And it's the steepness of the shape and the length of the reed over that hole that allows you to get the right tone. And you have to play around with this. Once you pull one of these out of the jig and insert your reed in there, you have to trim it back, blow it, trim it back, narrow it up, maybe sand some of this to get your right tone out of it. And that's where a lot of experience comes in hand, because you need to know how it's supposed to sound when you're doing these
things. But it's not just the making of the call. It's how to...
Well, blowing, it's a difference.
Exactly. That's what I mean, is that I was watching your hand. I was watching your breath.
Yeah. Well, you're blowing from your stomach up, from your abdomen. You're pressurizing your whole... All your lungs with air, and you're blowing. You're not blowing through your mouth like you do a horn or something like that. It's like huh, huh. It's almost like a cough, but you're actually, when I quack, 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 meh, meh, I'm doing that.
Uh-huh.
And when I'm doing a feed call, I'm going tick 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 tick.
Did you learn all that when you were a kid?
Yeah, I did.
Uh-huh. From your grandfather.
I learned it from my grandfather. And I know the audience can't see right now, but here's a picture of me on my grandfather's workbench when I was 21 months old, learning how to blow a duck call.
You were a sweet little boy, weren't you? You didn't have that beard that you have.
And that's right.
Always had since I met you. And that's your grandfather. How about your father? Did he not do any of this?
My father did some duck call. He made some duck calls, but he wasn't into it as much as my grandfather was.
Uh-huh. There's way more about this than I ever would have imagined. By the way, you also make the decoys.
I have made some decoys.
Yeah, I've seen those. The way that I learned about your duck calls and the decoys was on Facebook.
Oh,
now, we are
yes.
Facebook friends. We never talked about this sort of thing when you were when we were working on the boats we worked on. I don't know that we talked all that much, actually.
We probably worked more.
I think we probably did. That's what we were expected to do, wasn't it? Well, this is wonderful. Okay, so this is from a newspaper article.
It's a newspaper in 1953 of my grandfather and his two cronies. They're in the basement in Morrison Street in Memphis, and they're showing people how to do it. And before he built these calls, the Ben John calls, he ended up used to carving them. And there's a picture on the bottom here of the calls they used to carve without using a lathe. They would use, back in those days, they used, you know, knives and little chisels and stuff like that.
These are beautiful, but they don't have to be beautiful to get the ducks to come in.
No, but that's basically, those calls are for collectors.
I see.
And the collectors out there really like them, too.
So I believe that sometimes, especially when the fields are flooded and I hear the sound of a shotgun up on the ridge from coming down in the valley, sometimes that's you, right?
Probably so.
You don't take these calls.
No, I take my working call, which is this one right here. This was just for going around and beating around in the brush and that kind of stuff. I've got a couple of working calls.
But your grandfather and your father and yourself primarily want to do the beautiful calls, huh?
Yeah.
That's the pleasure of it. And there's also income in doing so, huh?
Oh, yeah.
For you and certainly for your grandfather.
Yeah, all the calls that you saw at the wooden boat show, at the woodworker show, probably. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you saw them or not.
I did not.
All those calls are similar to this one and this one right here. They all went to collectors down in
our... So looking at, and again, our... I should take some pictures and I can put them on the Facebook page. I will, or maybe you can send me some pictures and I can put them. I will do that this weekend. I will post
okay.
So people can see on the Toss Salad Facebook page.
Oh, yeah, perfect.
Yeah, you know, what we're really talking about.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And, for example, the ones you told me that your grandfather's, that those are really valuable nowadays.
They're really valuable nowadays, yeah. There's like this particular call that's on the table right here. One similar to that one sold for like at an auction in Illinois. It's an auction house that does decoys and hunting memorabilia and that kind of, and duck calls. The one like that sold for like $17,000 2 years ago. I have another one here, a smaller one, different that I've seen on that sold for like $9,000. But some of these calls.
So you actually have a fortune in duck calls.
I've got bags.
But you're not going to sell them because they're family heirlooms.
They're family heirlooms. I'll just give them down to my – well, I don't have any kids, but my brother has kids, and he has kids. So they'll go down – they'll stay in the family.
Uh-huh. You have a book in your hand.
This is a – my grandfather's in this book, this guy about – book by Howard Harlan. As a friend of mine. And this particular call on this page right here was built by a guy named James Beckert in Arkansas, near where my grandfather had his houseboat. And Beckert, his calls, one, I think this was the one, it sold at that auction house 2 years ago, bought by a fisherman here in Mount Vernon for $103,000.
I would imagine that they appreciate over time, too, don't they?
Oh, yeah.
That's what collecting is all about.
Yeah. This one was probably made around 1910.
Are there contests, duck call contests?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Every state has a state duck call championship thing happening. And if you get into one of those, if you rank high in one of those, then you get to go down to the Worlds in Arkansas. And I happened to go down there, and I blew in the Worlds in Arkansas in 1971. I didn't win it, but some of the old timers came over to me and asked me what kind of call I had, and I showed them. I said, "Oh yeah, I knew your grandfather." So that was kind of a treat.
Was this one that he made, or one that you made after him?
Oh, one that he made.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
And how long ago did you make your first?
My first call probably made when I was, maybe 5 or 6.
Uh-huh. So tell me about the hunting culture of Mississippi where you were raised.
Well, everybody likes to duck hunt. The culture has changed a lot since I was down there in the 50s and 60s.
Can you move the microphone a little bit? So that it's between you and or do that. That's fine, too.
The hunting culture has changed. Right now, it's kind of gotten real commercialized. It's hard to find a place to hunt unless you pay a farmer, a lot of money to rent his property to be able to hunt there. However, there are federal lands, wildlife reserves that you can go hunt at. And the people who don't want to pay a lot of money to go hunt in these other places can go there, so it's kind of crowded.
But when you were coming up and it was a
when
family,
I was coming up, mm-hmm. It was like we could go down to the Mississippi River, we could go to the Wolf River, we could go to these little lakes and ponds all over the place, and there were ducks everywhere. And one of my favorite hunting spots was the Tom Bigby River. The Buttahatchee and the Tom Bigby came together and made the Tom Bigby. These two rivers, one came out of northern Mississippi, one came out of Alabama. And when they got into the Tom Bigby River, it was premier duck hunting grounds. And especially since when the river would flood, it would flood out into the timber. It'd come out of its banks and be in the woods and ponds and pools and stuff like that. And what you'd need to do, we knew where they were. We'd find an open place in the woods where it was flooded, go in there, set our decoys up, and the mallards would just flock in. You didn't even really have to blow, unless you just really wanted to get their attention. But they would just come in and feed on acorns and wild seeds and stuff like that. So the duck hunting those days was just magical. It was just amazing. You get up early in the morning. Sometimes you're breaking ice to get out to the spot, you know. You're in a canoe or a little boat, and it's way before daylight. And even before light, you can hear ducks flying and quacking around. So you get excited. So and then you would wait for them to come in. And have a good day.
And now do you hunt by yourself?
I have two cronies I hunt with. Lon, who's a friend of mine, who's from Louisiana, he grew up duck hunting down there. And he and I and another friend of mine, Michael, we go to Roger Short's and set up and get around the area, you know, and hunt there. We have a good time.
You make boats, too. I mean, you've made all kinds of boats, I'm sure, but boats specific for duck hunting.
I have. Yeah, I just made my last boat last year. It was a what they call a layout boat. It's a very flat, kind of wide-looking little boat, very short. It's only 7.5 feet long. And it's kind of like a little box but it has little wings that come out. So you sit right down in the boat, and you're sitting below water. So, and then the top of the boat, the gunnels, is just raised above water a little bit. So I'm just peeking over the top of the gunnels, and I'm only about 6 inches above the water. And then at Roger's place, he's got all these big grasses growing all over the place. So I cut those grasses and make kind of like a woven tarp, kind of like a mat. I make a mat at them, and I put that over the top of this thing. And it looks just like the lay of the land. You know, you're very camouflaged. So I made that boat, and I'm going to be making a couple more this summer.
Okay, I need to take a short break here. I need to tell people the radio station's KPTZ. We are on the radio. We're talking kind of southern talk, northern talk, but the southern part of it is intriguing to me especially. KPTZ 91.9 in Port Townsend. Well, you know, we're talking about Shimakum Valley. And there's several things out in Shimakum Valley, including Shimakum, including Farms Reach Cafe. And, you know, a couple words about Farms Reach Cafe. I'm going to say a couple things, and then I'm going to get Ben to just demonstrate a bunch of these calls, because I had no idea that there's such a vocabulary. We're going to get the vocabulary and the variety of calls in just a minute.
Support for KPTZ is provided by Farms Reach Cafe, a welcoming place to meet for farm fresh, local, organic breakfast and lunch. Did you know they take orders for special desserts? Made from scratch with love. Located on Highway 19 in downtown Shimakum.
Indeed, that is the case. Downtown Shimakum, a couple miles down the valley, is where this duck hunting is going on. Now, I will tell you coming up on Toss Salad after I talk to Ben, Tigran Arkalian is going to come to talk about Sunday's concert by the Port Townsend Community Orchestra. And he's bringing a guitarist who's going to be the featured soloist, Sero Bebikian. Hey, there you go. You've heard me say this already, I suppose. I worked on the pronunciation, which is probably wrong, but at least I tried to be consistent. Not all night last night, but a bunch of times, enough times that I think probably I was getting pretty boring around the household. And then Judith Kate Friedman, Songs from the Sound, she's bringing with her Chicago Bob Longmire. He's the author of now the second book, Chicago Bob's Blues Jam Cheat Sheets. I don't know, my voice is kind of weird here. And then Heather Dudley Nolette is going to read In Winter, the Snow Never Stops by Michael Corvino. I suppose we're glad to say it finally did. Ben, the weather that I did not experience because I was in Mexico, but the weather that y'all probably experienced, how is that? What effect does that have on the likelihood of your getting ducks to come to you?
You mean the snows we just had?
Yeah, the
snows. The season was over by that time.
Oh, there's a season, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a season. It ended January 27th. But if the snow had been earlier during the season, it wouldn't have probably affected very much. Although if the snow is covering all the feed, then the ducks will have to go someplace else. Like when it freezes, the lake out there, the pond, the fields freeze, and I go to the mouth of Discovery Bay. You can hunt there, where Salmon Creek and Snow Creek come in there. There's like somebody keeps putting a blind up out there, and we don't use that blind, but we go out there in our little boats and set up in decoys in the grasses and reeds right next to the tides. And playing the tides is kind of you have to play the tides when you're down there because the tides go in and out, and you have your decoy set up, and it's perfect. And then the tide goes out, and your ducks are in the mud. So you have to go
high and dry, huh?
High and dry. But it's interestingly enough, the ducks feed in the water along the edges when it's only like 6 or 8 inches deep, and they're feeding in the mud. And as the tide go, they just keep following the edge all the way out. And so you see a lot of ducks feeding out there.
And by the way, I don't think I said more than about once. This is Ben Tyler I'm talking with. Buddy from the Marine Trades. But oh, the third.
Yeah, I'm the third one.
You are the third one. Well, I didn't know there was a first and second, but actually I guess I should have known that because on one of the calls I saw senior. Okay. One more thing, and then I want to just hear a bunch of calls. And you're gonna announce them and explain what they're for and tell what you're doing. But my and now late father-in-law hunted ducks. Mm-hmm. And he hunted ducks during the time that I knew him. And now I'm wondering what happened to his decoys, what happened to his call, and gone, I guess. Where did he live? Well, at that time, he lived on Hood Canal.
Oh, okay.
But he grew up in Wisconsin lived in eastern Oregon as well. But I was mentioning it, and he would go hunting with a relative, in fact, up in the Nooksack Valley. Forgot about the Nooksack part. But so he'd bring home these ducks. And were they tough or what? I mean, we did eat some. I mean, I'm not fussy about that sort of thing, but there must be ways of preparing what you catch, what you shoot, that makes them more palatable than what Grandpa Bob was doing.
The Ouijin ducks we have around here, if they're feeding a lot in the salt water, they've got like a little bit of a strong flavor to them. So usually what I do is I soak them in white vinegar for a couple of hours, and then I cook them with a little bit of bacon on them.
When am I invited to dinner here?
I've got a bunch of ducks in the freezer. I'll let you know.
All right. Well, by the way, speaking of family stuff, early on I meant to say hello to Sue. You probably want to say hello to Sue. She must have the radio on, despite the fact she's at work. But
she's at work right now, and she's probably wanting to be at home or something else. Or maybe she loves riding her bike, so she might be wanting to be riding her bike right now.
Does she know that she can listen and you can listen to this for 2 weeks on the radio station website? Program archive? Yeah, indeed you can.
Oh.
Go to kptc.org, dial up, and you'll see the button to click on Program Archive, and then pick the show, pick the hour, and here you'll be, quack, quack.
I'll be quacking on there. Mm-hmm.
So let's have maybe not every call, but as many as you feel like you want to sound. You'll have to explain what is that.
Okay, this is a call that I got. I didn't make this one, but it's made by I can't remember. I think this was made by Duck Commander, some guys down in Louisiana that make calls. And I carry this one with me down to Rogers. I have three calls I carry. These two here are mallard calls, and then this one is everything else. And there's a lot of teal down there. And the male teal will have like a little chirp. And that'll be the male teal. And then there's the Ouijans down there have a different call. And as they're flying over in flocks of 40 to 50, which they do, you'll hear that. And they're calling down to the water, trying to find other teal or Ouijans calling back. So they'll locate them and know where to go. So you hear the ones on the water doing, and the ones flying in the air, just communicating back and forth. And that'll bring a bunch of birds in. Now, later on in the late part of the season, we have a bunch of pintails. And they have a kind of a raspy kind of. And you'll hear them. When I go out to Rogers in the evening before the next morning hunt, I'll go out there and just listen and kind of locate where they are that for that next morning. And you'll hear Ouijans over here, a few mallards over here. You'll hear pintails over here. And then you'll realize, mainly to figure out where am I going to set up, how I'm going to set up my decoys the next morning. And then this is my working call. This is the one I carry with me all the time. It's got a little bit of a rasp to it. And these are the main calls I use down there, the working calls.
Yes, one of them looks like it's glass.
This one is a polycarbonate. I'll show you how this one sounds. See, it's a higher pitch. This call right here is what they call a loud call, and it's not for timber. It's for open areas, open fields, and stuff like that. So it's a loud call, and it's supposed to it carries a long distance. And you can scare ducks away by using this call in a closed area because it's way too loud even for them. So they know, okay, that's somebody blowing a duck call. Let's not fly over that way. Their decoys look weird. The call sounds weird. Let's fly over here instead. So ducks are a lot smarter than most people think. They're pretty wary. In late season, they're pretty wary about duck hunting and decoys and somebody making a move, that kind of thing, you know, seeing movement. So it's fun.
It certainly is. Well, you have three more, I believe. Well, maybe more in the bag there. We have about five more minutes. Ben Tyler. That's a beautiful one there.
This one was made in 1920. My grandfather made that one. And this is what they call a metal reed call. There's a piece of brass right in here. And instead of the tone board being curved down, the tone board is straight, and the metal is curved to give you the right shape for the sound. I haven't blown this one in a long time, so I don't know what it's going to sound like. It's a more quiet of a call.
It is, indeed. It's a sweet sound.
This is a more of a timber call. It's like closed in. And that was that call there. Here's one of his calls he made. Oops, let's see. This was the bread and butter of his business. They call a Ben John Deluxe. This is the one just like this that sold for that auction for like $9,000.
It's very simple.
Yeah, and it's got like, it's mahogany, a cedar throat. It's a metal reed. I haven't blown this one in a long time either. The Ducks Unlimited main headquarters in Memphis want me to donate this one to their museum. I'm still thinking about it.
Uh-huh. That's a family heirloom indeed.
A family heirloom. Uh-huh. Although I do have about a dozen of these just
you
like
do.
This. I do.
You're a wealthy man, Ben Tyler. But what good is it? Because, again, they're family.
They're family, yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, this has been, I've been quite taken by this conversation. It's more than I expected.
I've enjoyed it myself.
Yeah, and nice to actually get together with you. Are you going to be going out for, no, I'm not going to be. I guess I can't say that. Well, we sometimes meet at the poorhouse.
Meet at the poorhouse. That's our stomping grounds.
Yeah. We see each other there, and you're making calls all the time.
I'm making calls. I just finished making this throat today.
Oh, we didn't hear that one.
That's not finished yet. This is African blackwood. You go down to the local hardware store, Eden Saws, and you buy this in blanks, and it's discarded clarinet making woods. Mm-hmm. They got a whole barrel full of them. You pick out the ones you want. So I just made that one to fit this one right here, but I haven't put the reed in or tuned it or not. This is the first one I started doing scrimshaw work on.
I can see that. It looks ancient.
Yeah, and then Sue and I were down in New Mexico last year, and we visited this old turquoise mine in Sierras, New Mexico, and I was able to get some turquoise from them, so I was able to do this turquoise inlay. There's another call out there that I made that I sold to a local coffee shop owner who had turquoise inlays, and he really likes it.
Ben, you are busier now that you're retired, aren't you?
I am busy.
Thanks for coming in. This has been fun.
It's been a lot of pleasure. Thank you very much.
And you're very welcome. We'll try some, maybe we'll do this again somehow. I don't know. Enjoy the lore and the legends that go in all of this as well.
Yeah, it's fun. Been fun.
Yeah, it has been
Thank
fun.
You.
Have a good afternoon and good hunting to you.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
I'll know what's going on a little bit better when I hear the booms coming from the valley. Mind you, it never really bothers me. My neighbors ask me kind of as if maybe I should know, and maybe they're a little resentful, and I say, well, that's my friend Ben.
You know who it is.
Well, maybe not always, but sometimes.